Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Are your wiper blades chattering, skipping, or squeaking? Don't let streaks or smearing on your windshield compromise your visibility. When it's time to replace your wiper blades, stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and see our selection. Our professional parts people will even install your new wiper blades while you wait. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
46% of Americans expect to leave behind financial obligations when they pass away, so it's crucial to make sure your family is financially protected. Policy Genius helps you find the right life insurance coverage by comparing options from America's top insurers with help from licensed, award-winning agents. Secure your financial future with Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com to get free life insurance quotes in just a few clicks. That's policygenius.com.
Hey, I'm KC.
I'm Eric.
I'm Tyler.
I'm Brianne.
Brain.
Brian.
Brian.
And you're listening to
The Element Podcast.
What's happening, all you people? Guess what? We're back to our old ways. We are truck casting. We're actually SUV casting right now. We're rolling in a Toyota 4Runner, which is pretty cool, man. Is it okay to talk about the vehicle? You said that for upland hunters, that's not that big of a deal, right?
I think.
This is Brian Cope with Ultimate Upland, by the way.
And Mike Peeker introducing
Mike Peeker
him.
Here. Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't, some guys, I don't know, talk about their trucks in upland. I don't find it to be a, oh, you're talking about hot spotting
being
trucks.
Sneaky. Yeah. No, yeah, I'm not saying that you don't like to, like, talk about how cool your vehicle is, because, I mean, it's a nice car.
It's average, but
yeah.
I don't know. I don't know how to even look at it that way, because I don't hunt next to the road.
But you usually do park next to the road.
Yeah.
So, if y'all don't know, that is the illustrious laugh of one Brain Cook, also known as Brian Coke, from Ultimate Upland, good friend of ours. We've been running around all over the upper Midwest. We also have Eric Gentry and Tyler Jones,
yo,
who y'all may know as being the actual part of the Element, and I'm just a voice from time to time, but we are headed to Michigan right now to scout some whitetail, scout some rough grouse, scout some lesser yellow legs.
Bears? Are the bears going to be there, or are we in a different part of the state?
It's pretty far south, I think, the area you're talking. So yeah, that'd be maybe. Yeah. I'm not going to say no, but
Michigan is known. Do you know this? Michigan is known in some circles as being the toughest state to hunt whitetails. Did you know that?
Why?
That's a good question. I don't. There's probably some guys who are, you know, yelling right now, but I don't really know why today. Hopefully, we'll see why, or maybe we'll disprove it. I don't know. I think that maybe what they really mean is the toughest state to shoot a big buck, and that could be true. That very well, because I feel like they have a very liberal season, somewhat liberal gun season too, isn't that right? Like they have the opportunity to shoot with guns.
I think more than anything, it comes down to the hunter population versus land mass.
You're saying pressure then?
Yeah, but I think that there's going to be a high deer population. I just think age structure is an issue in Michigan, but I'm not sure of that.
Well, the good part about Michigan, I mean, from a rough grouse hunting, but probably also a deer hunting, is the amount of public access land is immense. I mean, a lot of people think of the Upper Peninsula because literally the bulk of the Upper Peninsula is access in some regard or the other, but the truth is even down in the Mitten, massive amounts of public access land. And for guys like you who are doing, you know, public deer hunting, I mean, it's I mean, in that regard, I would just think it would be just almost perfect. So when you say it's tough, the rep is that it's tough to, I don't know, kill a big deer or eight deer, it just seems fascinating to
me. Everybody except the blatantly obvious ones like to say, man, our state's the toughest there is. You know, like, you name one outside of, like, Iowa or
Illinois,
or maybe, that's really about it, honestly. Like, everyone else.
Well, even if it's, it could be micro-regional, too, because, like, Ohio, which we have been in, a lot of people wouldn't say that about their state, but they might say, oh, I hunt this big, huge state forest in the southern portion of the state. That's the toughest hunting that there is, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
And so, like, people do like that whole, like, man, my hunting's the toughest kind of thing, you know?
So
and
you just think it's a lens that the Michiganders are looking through going, our deer hunting?
Not
stuff?
All of them. And they probably have a leg to stand on in some sense, but there's a deer right over there.
I think there's a heavy deer hunting culture there, and so with that, a lot of the percentage of the population accepts and does hunt, and with that, it just seems like everybody's in the woods during gun season and deer are dying, and
there's probably no passing of deer either, and that's probably why you're not seeing big bucks grow, is because you're probably not going to pass up.
There's not a lot of passing by, from what I understand, and I think that also just being that Michigan is kind of this peninsula or island almost in the north of the U.S. is kind of like, well, the deer are here and the people are here and we don't have a whole lot of space to expand, maybe, you know, they kind of had that feeling that they're just kind of trapped in, and and so everybody's just shooting deer or whatever.
But we've got a buddy named Sam Hogan who kills a lot of big public land bucks up here, so it can be done.
When we get up over that way, the feeling trapped part, I think you guys are going to be like shot. I mean, I know there's lots of people, but we're going to get over that way, and because I've spent quite a bit of time up there hunting rough grouse, I feel like it's, compared to Ohio, it's wide open, honestly. And that's my take. Oh, it'll be interesting what you guys think.
Wide open, what do you mean by wide?
It just feels like there's more area with less structures.
Gotcha.
I mean, it just feels like it to me.
The human density is a little lower.
It's wilder.
To me, it feels like it could be distorted. Like, you know, in my lens, might be different. But when I go over to Michigan and hunt, it feels like it's just better environment for hunting.
You know, we ran into
like
that
this
yesterday.
Whole my lens might be distorted thing.
Yeah.
I like this.
Yeah, man, that's a humble
take. We weren't hearing a whole lot of that from the front seat earlier yesterday. Not just you, but the whole front section of the truck, you know.
We ran into that a little bit yesterday when we went to Pennsylvania. We went to the Allegheny National Forest and did some map scouting there. Found some really cool stuff, but the whole time Tyler and I were both saying how we thought it was going to be way wilder than what it actually was. Mm-hmm. Like, there was little camps, vacation homes, even big homes, like, throughout that thing. Yeah. You know, I thought we were going up into the hills, you know?
Yeah.
And it just didn't really have that wild feel. It did whenever we kind of got back into some stuff. But for the most part, you were, like, within 3 miles of a house almost everywhere we went.
Yeah,
you know?
And less than a mile from a road.
Yeah.
Or an unimproved road, I'll say. I won't necessarily, you know, depends on what your definition of road is. But
yeah, that was a big conversation yesterday, too. Yeah, it's tough.
Well, so what's your, I want to go back to, you said it's not, the impression is not big bucks. So what, so give me, what are we talking, in Michigan?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, so what are your thoughts on what a big Michigan buck would be? I don't deer hunt, so I'm curious what you guys say big in Michigan is, or what you think it is.
And I don't really know that for sure, but to me, I feel like Michigan has the genetic potential to grow some really big bucks. They have for the crops and everything.
Especially southern.
Crops and cover, man.
And we're going to kind of go southern central today, I guess, is where we're going to be, right?
Yeah.
So kind of the palm of the mitten, right?
Yeah, right in the center.
That's where you want that grounder to land.
That's right. But I would say it's more of an age class than it is antlers. So, like, I think Michigan has a hard time getting 4.5-year-old deer.
I think they have a hard time getting 3.5 from, or at least that's what I've understood.
Yeah.
I think most people would consider a 3.5-year-old northern buck to be a pretty big animal.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think that the way I understand it, from a lot of people that I've heard talk about it or talk to about it is, you know, 2.5-year-old bucks and less is kind of what they're seeing most of the time. A 3-year-old gets shot pretty much almost throughout the state.
Not divulge too much, one sort of famous podcaster once referred to this concept.
Ooh.
A mature buck in Michigan is a 2.5-year-old deer, because that's, he referred to maturity as being relative.
Yeah.
Which is relative
maturity.
Relative maturity.
From what I understand, the bone structure of a whitetail.
That's a fascinating idea.
Matures in the 4.5-year-old age.
Yeah, well, really 5, but 4.5. There's like,
I've heard the bone
done.
Structure stops growing in the 4.5-year-old age.
I think that it's like 95%. So that's probably, it's probably one of those things where like some do, some don't. Kind of like, you know, how dudes are. Like, my bone structure was 95% done in 8th grade, you know.
So. Why are humans so much vastly different than animals? You know what I mean? Like that. Like, we have such... You and I walked into a convenience store earlier, and there was a dude that walked around the corner, and we were like, whoa,
that's a big dude. Yes. Like, man, is this guy ex-NFL or
what? It's like,
what?
If that was a deer, that's a 400-pound deer, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, but why don't those really... You don't see these... You know what I mean?
I think it's because humans have immigrated and immigrated all over the world, so we have a huge melting pot of genetic diversity. Whereas, like, in Michigan, they do have, in Maine, they do have 400-pound whitetails, but those don't just randomly show up in, you know, northern Ohio in a convenience store, you know what I mean? Like, so that guy is probably Germanic, you know, from, you know, his lineage or whatever, and they're huge.
Nice, Polish.
What's the heaviest whitetail ever weighed?
I think it was ridiculous. I think it's in Michigan, it's like 466 or something like that. Or not Michigan, I keep saying Michigan, in Maine, that's what I mean.
What? So let me get this straight. Are we saying that relative maturity in whitetail is a thing, or are we saying it's not a thing?
That is pseudoscience.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
And then we're sticking with that for people too?
Because
it sounded like you were just vouching for relative maturity in terms of were mature in eighth grade in a physical sense.
We have to think about this in ratios.
I don't know how to think about it, because it's the first time I've ever heard the term, so I'm trying to understand.
You know, you'll know how this works.
Give me a bird reference.
Yeah, dog ears. Which is kind of a anthropomorphic thing anyways. But you know what I'm saying about dog ears, right? So people like to say, well, dog, you know, 1 year for us and 7 years for a dog, whatever. All that is a ratio of saying dogs only live 10 to 12, 14 years old.
Yeah, but relative maturity is a different thing.
I know, but let me finish my thought, maybe you'll understand what I'm saying. If a whitetail were matured at 2.5 for relative maturity, it would be as if a human matured at 8 years old, as opposed to 17 or 18, like we do physically matured. You know what I mean? As opposed to like how like humans, we don't have a date range of between 8 and 28 where people physically mature. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, but there's a different rate, right?
What do you mean?
Well, you just said that you were physically mature at eighth grade.
Yeah, but if you take the ratio down, that's the difference in a deer maturing and, like, with their bone structure in February of their fourth year and in September of their fourth year.
I got you.
You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So let me throw out a few facts here if y'all are done with that conversation.
I like facts. Go.
Okay, so, well, these are, I mean, I don't know what is a fact, you know, but this deer and deer hunting article talks about the heaviest bucks ever killed, and
Steve Bartilla.
It looks like that the heaviest whitetail ever shot was killed by a bow hunter in Ontario. The deer field dressed 431 on a government certified scale.
Field dressed 431.
Estimated live weight would be more than 540.
Oh my goodness.
Second place belongs to a 402-pound Minnesota buck. That is dressed 402 pounds. Mm. There is another one from Maine, 355 dressed. Fourth place, 321 from Wisconsin. And fifth place was 291 dressed.
That's a lot of variance.
I know.
I feel like there's a lot of people not weighing their deer is the problem.
Yeah, possibly. But doesn't that interest you in some regard? Like,
oh, absolutely.
Why, is Maine on the list because there'd be a way to kill a big buck in a different sense of the word?
Oh, yeah. Actually, Maine hunters judge deer by their weight because they don't have good genetic antlers.
Yeah, that's something that you guys would put on the list and go, that's something I'd be down to try and kill the biggest bigger-bodied animal. Oh,
we were talking about this on the way up here.
I would love to shoot a big-bodied deer.
I think that's fascinating just in terms... not being a big deer-hunting guy, which is strange.
You're not big at all.
Yeah.
Definitely these days.
But I'm relatively mature.
We're trying to figure out how relatively. Yeah.
60 or so.
But I think it's... I've never heard of this thing you just unleashed on me, and that there's a different scale, literally a different scale of measuring big buck in a different part of the country. I think that's fascinating.
Do you mean by the maturity scale? Is that what you're saying, or what are you saying?
No, I'm saying that you're saying that people in Maine measure their deer's, how big a deer is, on body weight.
Yeah, it's cool.
I've never heard anybody say that before.
Yeah.
It's not like I haven't been around the outdoors. Mm-hmm. So that would make me go, well, because everybody's so enthralled by the size of antler, I just would like go, wow, I want to go do a body weight hunt.
You want to go hunt a deer?
Well,
no, he's hunting for more body weight.
If I were in your seat,
we do that, but just not on quite that scale.
I hunt for body weight after I kill a deer. I eat a lot of cookies.
Donuts.
Of course, we go to other states because the antlers are bigger.
Yeah.
But don't think that it is lost how much bigger the body size is. It's one of the things that we just marvel
at. It's the first thing you notice, I think, when you're from Texas, when you walk up on a deer.
Because
not passing on a deer. So this is an interesting thing. You're not passing on a deer with big antlers because you could go, dang, there's a possibility that there's a bigger body deer out there.
In some sense, we do. Because they're, like, here's the deal. This is tough. When you're a public land hunter, a lot of times you take whatever you can get because your encounters aren't high. But say, for instance, like, some of Tyler, I'm not going to speak for you, but I'm going to a little bit, like, some of Tyler's past hunting has been done on a private lease in the Midwest. And
what?
They have... like a situation where sometimes they have two or three year old deer that have bigger antlers than the 7-year-old deer. And like, say for instance, in 2015 Tyler shot a deer that they'd named One-Eyed Jack that was a huge bodied big old buck, but was like a low 150s type buck, probably like that.
maybe and that was his biggest year. He may have made the 150s,
but there's
that's on YouTube though, right?
Is yes
that, yeah, yeah. I think I've seen
there's
that
there's there was probably a 4-year-old on the lease that year that scored more than him.
Oh yeah, right? There's several deer that year that were bigger
antlers.
Yeah,
so you made that decision, but that wasn't a conscious decision on body weight. It was an age thing. Like, you'd track that deer.
Yeah,
right?
I would say body weight is probably kind of a
we're trying to let them hit
factor.
That relative maturity.
Yeah,
I don't know. This whole thing is news to me, but I just wonder if, you know, how high on the list it would be to go, you know, try and kill the biggest body deer.
I guess what's the definition of maturity, though? Because you can use maturity in a couple different ways.
Well, I don't think deer mature, like, socially.
Because deer's antlers were at 7, were the biggest that they ever were.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make it finally a mature rack? Has the rack finally matured?
I think most people consider maturity in bone structure. That's what they're actually talking about.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, socially they mature too, isn't that? That's your
sort of, but that's like within the first couple years.
You don't think a smart old buck learns in a social
that's
sense
true.
More?
That's true.
I mean, they get harder to hunt, so you would think that they're getting better, right?
Well, maybe
I don't know. I'm asking. I mean, you know, open ended.
I don't know if that is, could you call that maturity? Because Bill Winky, who is one of the guys I respect the most, says that deer after about 6 get easier to hunt. When you're on private land, when he's in a controlled environment, because he says at that point in time their home range starts to shrink and they become very habitual, and in that 6 and 7 age range they are easier to kill than
well,
they
it's
are
like
at
old
4.
People are easier to kill too, right?
Yeah.
Like an old
Andrew Cuomo, right?
But isn't that that's kind of a skewed thing, because a 6 or 7 year old deer is like elderly, right?
Deer are not like us. They do not get old and fat and, like, just bad shape, because they don't
That's, wait, deer's teeth wear down to nothing, just like old people.
Sure,
right?
But yeah, that's like at 13 or 12.
Yeah. Maybe I had the years wrong, but yeah. I'm just saying, like, at 6 or 7, they're on the decline.
No, not dude, they're like a ripped up Sylvester Stallone at 60
so,
at that point in time.
Yeah, maybe not even that age, you know, because you're 60, right? So my wife's uncle has a place that they hunt down in South Texas, and they try not to shoot deer until they are 7.
Huh.
So they say that, and this South Texas is literally where, you know, quality deer management was started. This is a place there, the highest, you know, biggest money in the world for deer hunting tends to go South Texas, and so they spend the most money and research down there on deer, and they say that 7 is when most of the deer have had enough time to fully develop body and antler wise.
Okay, but to circle back to the social thing with deer, even though the guy that you respect goes at 6 or 7, they get easier to hunt. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that the deer isn't learning. It means learning more. It doesn't mean that the deer has actually learned how to better conserve. And I mean, you know, like it seems to me that that's not the deer de-learning. It's de-learning in terms of hunting. But yeah, isn't that deer still learning to better use its own resources?
Well, I think here's the question.
That's why maturity is.
Is that a finish line, or is mature a process that you never finish?
That's
now
exactly
we're
right.
Really,
this is what I was
conceptual.
Saying when I was saying you have to define maturity.
Yeah,
because
yeah, I got you.
Technically, your personality throughout your whole life, and the same as a deer, is going to probably change here and there. I mean, shot that buck Frankenstein, you know, that was probably 12 years old, we figured, at least.
Yeah, he was geriatric.
I mean, he was literally super habitual, but still moving long distances, but like, also, he would run downhill because he was kind of arthritic and would just, like, you could tell he was limping just from, you know, being old. And just, he would run downhill because he didn't have the muscle mass to stop himself.
So
you know, kind of like Brian, but.
So his bone structure, exactly like me, but his bone structure, only one of us got up and worked out this morning, by the way, in this car, the oldest one. But that 12-year-old deer, Frankenstein, that video's up too, right?
Yeah.
So. Bone structure. Are we talking about skeletal bone structure, or are we talking about antler structure would have been on a decline?
Huh?
Yeah, the antler structure would be on a decline in that case.
And the skeletal structure as well. I mean,
you would assume,
probably
yes.
Say it's all the same, right?
I would assume it's pretty close.
I feel as if antlers are not bones.
But what about bone collector?
Yeah, I know, right?
Right. I just saw a truck pass this not too long ago with that sticker on it,
yeah.
And I was like, okay, but what? So what? Give me the breakdown on that, I guess. I mean, if you
antlers,
want to, you don't have to walk me down that path. But
I'm no biologist, right? But from my understanding, antlers are kind of a halfway point between bones and keratin structure, like your fingernails. Is that?
I have no clue.
Yeah.
So I've always thought of them as a bone that.
Yeah.
Oh.
But there's no marrow in an antler. But it's kind of like.
Not hard antler, there isn't? Like a soft, in velvet antler?
I don't know. I think all
there's
the.
There's blood flow going through there,
yeah,
right?
I don't know. Somebody might have to. I probably shouldn't speak from a point of knowledge on this.
Well, if it's like a fingernail, how about that? When people are stuffed in coffins, don't their fingernails keep growing?
Is that a
no? See,
no, I'm pretty sure that's
that.
A real thing.
How do you know?
Hopping
in
I used
coffins.
To work in a cemetery.
Did you?
Yeah.
And you
no,
dug them
you
up?
Didn't.
Yeah, I did.
Did you really?
I did.
Yeah, but how do you know that their fingernails kept growing?
I don't. I'm just wanted to.
Just
I just wanted
their
to
wallets.
Bring that in there. I just wanted to bring the fact that I've worked in a cemetery.
So, would you like me to tell you one of Tyler's whitetail fantasies?
I'm not sure, but maybe.
It is to,
like,
to
can,
kill,
we can always delete it, right?
Can we drop some ludicrous music right here, please?
To kill a buck in a cemetery.
Right?
Yeah.
So there's potential
right
for
the,
that
right
in a few places out west, because some family cemeteries sit on public access.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not truly public ground, but public access. So that would be potential.
I know.
But
we've seen some stuff like that. We saw something in Illinois like that, I think, too.
Yeah.
There's some stuff. I imagine South Dakota would have something like that, too.
That's true. Yeah, because I remember passing a cemetery. I took a this will sound morbid. My mom is trying to have me come up with what her headstone's going to look like. Yeah, my parents are old.
I think it's just be like a your head.
I was taking a picture of one of the headstones, which was on a piece of public access where we were pheasant hunting.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well,
I don't know that it would be ideal for deer. I think that's the problem with that fantasy is the intersection of good deer habitat and that cemetery would be really, that'd be a hard thing to find, but it'd be really cool. I mean, it's out there, I'm sure.
In some of the more Midwestern states, a lot of times cemeteries are kind of a clearing in a wooded area. It's a good spot to find scrapes.
Yeah, there's also green grass there.
Mm-hmm.
The other way you could look at it in the Midwest, what we were talking about at my house, is how they give out, it's not nuisance permits, but you can hunt within city limits.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's, you know, the deer population close to the national park is just skyrocketing, so they have to control the population somehow. So
why?
The interesting part would be, well, no, right, I mean, just let them go.
Preservation.
Right, preservation. I'm all for it. But you might be able to find a city where you could actually hunt in city limits and have that be the point. That probably is the most, has the most potential.
I'm really looking forward to a time when I can work a little less than I do right now, so I can focus on things that are fun like that. You know what I mean? Not that I don't focus on things that are fun, but like there's some cool things that I think, oh, this would be cool to do. Like go hunting with Brian on the Missouri River. You know? Like I want to do that, but I know that that time of year, right now, this, you know, to be a very hip season of my life, I'm not able to go do that with you, but I would love to at some point. And so
yeah,
hopefully,
but you're part of your normal work, you could just go to Maine and try and kill the biggest bodied deer on record.
Definitely could. It's just the issue is actually doing that, because if you don't, then nobody cares. Work harder, right, Casey?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Work harder.
Absolutely. Nobody cares. That's why Brian got up this morning and told us all about his workout.
I didn't tell you about it.
He did.
I was going for a hike.
No, you
asked
me. Yeah.
But you still told me. I didn't go tooting my horn. You were asking, homeboy.
But you told me.
Right.
If you had a true humble nature, you'd be like, I wasn't.
True humble nature.
All right.
That's what I'll do. I did. I asked Brian because I was interested to see what he did.
Brian is a humble guy.
He is. Brain.
Brain cooked us some waffles, chicken and waffles last night.
They were so good.
They were so good. Cooked us a steak with, what are those things? Ramps?
Yeah.
Ramp butter.
Ramp butter.
What's going over here with this huge Florida weave? Is that a pepper farm?
Oh.
So northwestern Ohio, the ag, there is stuff you'd see in other parts. The soil out here changes, and it gets more sandy in this part. And So there are farms that grow tomatoes. Like Heinz has commercial contracts with some of these guys. Cucumbers, I know for sure.
I bet they don't have any deer problems.
Those look like peppers, I'm telling you.
It could have been. I don't know all of them, but
and they had Florida weave across every row in that 60 acres right there.
The weird part about watching them harvested on machines, have you seen any of that stuff? Like, I haven't seen it in person, but I've seen like videos.
Is there a guy sitting there?
There's a guy like leaning over, like pulling them and putting on a conveyor belt. But there's a Heinz has some facilities out here where they're processing them, and it's not just it's ketchup and relish and all kinds of stuff, I assume. But it's big stuff out this way.
Well,
it's
not so, not joking. What's the percentage of the population here that has a German last name?
And
you and Steve both do.
How do you spell joke?
How do you spell joke?
Is that with one O or two?
I don't know.
J-U-K. And that strange symbol.
Yeah.
The German symbol.
Two dots.
But, I mean, it's real heavy German, huh?
It just depends on what part of Ohio.
Well, I mean, we're still... Heinz is German.
But... Yeah, it is.
Anyways,
I don't know.
So
that's interesting.
Let's talk about your hunt a little bit, because I just alluded to it, but you have a pretty awesome hunt that you're wanting to do this year. Is this something we can talk about much, or are you trying to keep people from stealing this from you?
I rarely. Can somebody jump in and try and do it before I do it this fall? Maybe.
There's some companies with money that could probably put some
Yeah, bird hunter. I don't know. It's just, you're gonna release this podcast next week, right?
Probably soon. Yeah,
maybe tomorrow. We ain't gonna talk about it then. Too early. They still got a month. They can activate. I mean, it's gonna be great. You know, I'll come back on after.
Let me ask you this then. You do a cool trip like every year, man. Like I guess kind of a big trip or whatever, for lack of a better term. In the past, it's been 14ers. We've talked about that a little bit. We may talk about it a little bit more here in a second. But you have had, in your 60 years, quite a bit of experience. And you are very, you think about things a lot and deeply. And I just feel like, I don't know if I can imagine there being another bird hunter out there like you. Are there other guys out there that are like you, that have the experience that you have? Or do you feel like, and this is a chance to be, you know, I don't want you to be humble and say, oh, well, yeah, there's, you know, I'm not the best or whatever. Like, I truly feel like, as far as upland hunting goes, like if I was just a general public person and I knew what you had done and where you'd been and all, I would go to you with any question about upland hunting. Do you feel like there are other guys out there like you?
Yeah, I don't. I hate to say probably not, but it's probably not, just because.
That's how I feel too, though.
I feel like, as you guys know, I'm just basically only ate up with upland birds. Like there's other guys who are versed in upland hunting, well versed and have accomplished, depending on what your definition of accomplished is, but. But they also do other things.
Mm-hmm. From what I have seen at least, you have two framed pictures of bobwhite quail in your house and one guinea fowl painting.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and there's probably more.
There's a picture of a grouse in the living room. I saw
It's one bob and one grouse. That's right.
And then.
Well, yeah, and the other thing that, the feathers on the wall are all my first birds across every grouse species, except for one, which is lacking. Yeah. There's a story behind that, but it bored most of your listeners.
Every North American grouse species, I'm assuming.
If you don't count ptarmigan. But yeah.
Yeah. But I would say, to echo what Tyler said, maybe you're not the best upland hunter, but you've done the coolest stuff of any. You know, like you've gone and done it. You know, who knows what best means when it comes to upland hunting? It's kind of like mature, right? Like, it's like, well, how do you determine that? Is the best shot? Is it the guy who knows the most about where birds are? You know, who knows, right?
Best dog trainer,
but as far
trainer,
as, like,
whatever.
Experience, I used to kind of talk about this a lot yesterday, and it's funny that we were debating. I'm sorry. I said that wrong.
It was funny.
I used to talk about this a lot, and yesterday we were I was debating the opposite side of the couch here, but I used to, and still somewhat do, consider myself an experienced hunter. Like, I'm looking for the experience much more than I am the means to an end.
Sure.
But I feel like you take that to good extremes.
Yeah, I take it to a strange level. I don't know if I feel pressure for that. I guess I do feel pressure for that, and I don't necessarily know why.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, probably in many ways, I'm driven by a sense of competition. I don't know why that, you know, I guess I always have been. I'm easily motivated by competition.
You're one of those people who's in competition with themselves, which are the most dangerous types of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's where I've kind of, it's turned that way, but I also can turn on people pretty quick. You point me in a direction, like, you know, push the wrong button and point me in a direction. And,
like the fat buck challenge or whatever y'all are doing right now?
I can get wound up pretty easy. You know, that translates into my bird hunting, and it also translates into conservation for me. Really, it translates into a lot of stuff. I don't, you know, it's just, I guess it's the way I'm woven. I can't undo it at this point, because I'm just, you know, when you're 60 years old, it's tough to learn new tricks.
Let me ask you this. A lot of people consider Michael Jordan, or it doesn't matter for this example, if you consider LeBron James being the best basketball player ever of all time, whoever it is, those guys are known worldwide. If you, and I'm saying this, I consider you as being one of the best, probably, bird hunters that exists. If you are, how come nobody knows who you are?
I don't know. It's not popular.
Bird hunting isn't, you're saying?
Bird hunting in general is not popular. The truth is that the average upland hunter, and we've had some of these conversations, but the average upland hunter, and I'd be hard-pressed to call them upland hunters, but, you know, because, again, the definition, but the average guy only hunts two times a year. They hunt on opening weekend at whatever state, and then they hunt on a holiday with their family. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it's just, it's not the, you know, upland birds and upland hunting is not in the front of most people's minds. So out of 11.5 million hunters in this country, then that number fluctuates and is going down, by the way, regardless of what year. Out of those 11.5 million hunters, maybe 900,000 of them, maybe a scad bit more would be or would call themselves upland hunters. So I got 900,000 people. Why don't all 900,000 know me? Well, I'm probably offensive to 450,000 of those 900,000 people. Because I've always been, I tell people I'm a black and white guy, like there's no middle ground for me, it's 50-50, not in my operation, it's just like literally, I've been this way all my life, like 50% of people can tolerate me and then 50% of people hate me. So, yeah, I got 450,000 people, and out of those 200,000 actually on YouTube, so
I'm not
this is not that I didn't mean to say nobody knows you either, because there you have some people that really do care about it that follow and watch your videos and, you know, are going to listen to this podcast and hopefully subscribe, but you know, like, I guess in, you know, we're talking about relative maturity earlier, we're going to talk about relative to MJ, you know, this is a lot smaller market, right?
Sure.
You know, so and then your integrity is probably another thing that makes it difficult for people to find who you are, right? Because you don't see a whole lot of dead bird pics on your Instagram. You know, I would, except for that one where you spelled out 150 in pheasants. Right?
Grimes on me. That's one of my. Oh, that's a nightmare. That's like nails on a chalkboard right there. Part of the problem is it's this, you know, it's, I've put myself in my own purgatory, which is I don't want to play by the game that makes things popular, you know, like I just refuse to, no matter what. I can't bring myself to do it. And then that makes me, hard to relate to, because the way I'm doing things, so we can talk about last season. We can't talk about what's coming up last season. I haven't released way up on season two, but so I call these trips way up on. You guys know that. Yep. Not very many other people know that. My big quote unquote challenging trip, I've termed it way up on. That's where it started with the 14ers. But last year I biked across the Missouri National Grassland on a fat bike, towing a trailer with my dogs, hunted the entire way. It's an insane thing to do, and just in terms of nobody else does it. Now, there's a faction of people out there that find it cool. There's also a pretty broad faction of people that are just like, well, I would never do that. That's stupid. You know, and so I don't know.
Yeah. Where's your trailer? Where are you bringing trailer?
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing?
Without offending two people, why can't you just go write stories for Outdoor Life on this? Because that's kind of, you know, that's where you heard about trips and stuff like that, you know?
But Outdoor Life knows their market, and they also know that upland bird hunting, you know, how many stories are in Outdoor Life about upland bird hunting in a year, and
there's not many about what you did, though. I mean, that's my thing, is like, I just I don't know, people need to know about what you're doing. It's cool, dude. It's awesome.
So I'm not, probably don't fall under the classification as upland hunter, like what we talked about, like the average upland hunter, for sure not, right? And maybe even not upland hunter at all, but I enjoy what you do and I appreciate it, and I think a lot of people would. Do you think that one of the reasons that you don't have, like, a huge following is that you haven't bought into the outdoor TV model? Do you think that there's a world where you could just get an outdoor TV spot and just get it out there and people be like, oh, wow, I didn't know. You know? Because I can tell you this. I remember one guy ever in my life. Like, I don't even know the names of famous upland hunters, right?
Yeah.
But do you know who I'm fixing to talk about? He had kind of like a flat rim type hat, and he had a setter dog, and he would go to different places.
Hunting with Hank.
Is that who that is?
That was the name of the dog.
Yeah. Hank's the name of the dog, yeah. Yeah, and that guy kind of has a mustache kind of guy, right?
Well, there's another guy, Scott Linden. He's one of the more famous guys. He has had a television show and has had a television model.
And that's the only reason, like, I even knew what upland hunting was because of the outdoor TV.
Yeah. I mean, if the question is could I bring myself to do that?
Yeah.
Not at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I can't. So, I know your audience probably doesn't know this, and maybe doesn't care, but almost all those shows that you see on television for upland hunting being quail and pheasant for most people, there's other species, I won't delve too deep into that, lots of other species by the way, but most people recognize quail and pheasant as upland hunting. The bulk of the shows that you see on television are canned hunts.
Mm.
Think of high fence deer hunting in the worst possible way you could possibly think of high fence deer hunting. I literally mean the worst possible way.
Yeah.
I mean,
the 20-acre pin stuff.
I'll let you guys tell me what that is, and then. But to tell you what it is in the upland world, or the upland preserve world, and you heard from Steve when he was... There's Steve calling right now. I just said his name. And
whoa.
Wow.
That was weird.
That was weird.
I'll call him back later. So, Steve, my buddy Steve, a lot of you guys see his content, or anybody, not a lot, but a few of you guys see his
some
content. But he's a guide, he's an upland guide to train his dogs, right? What an upland guide at one of these preserves does is, Tyler and Casey said something to Steve about, well, you put the birds out the night before or something to him, and he's like, no, I literally plant the birds an hour before we hunt. So mm-hmm. these are pin-raised pheasant or pin-raised quail or pin-raised checker, oh boy, that are, and half the time the birds are dizzied. Essentially, you
put them in a sack or whatever.
You shake the bird until it's so dizzy, and then you tuck its head under its wing, and if you sit it in the grass, that way it will be there, no matter what. So the shows you're watching on television are preserve birds, pin ray stuff, and it's because filming moving targets, upland flying birds, it's just tough to pull that all together from a photography and videography perspective.
Need a lot of chances to get that on film.
Yeah. And so, you know, they're using these dizzy birds at preserves, and it's just, for me, it's so different from what a wild bird hunt is. It's offensive to my senses.
Yeah.
But you can produce your show however you'd like.
This is kind of what I was about to say. Right. Is like, okay, so there's, everybody knows the meat eater model, right? It started out on this a little bit different, you know, than the outdoor TV typical model, right? Where, you know, at first maybe guys were not real sure what to think because, you know, this guy kind of didn't really show a lot of hunting and showed more of like preparing a meal afterwards or whatever. Is there a way to do that? Is it worth your time and money, and or do you need money behind that, or what's the, you know, what's stopping you from doing that?
Well, the meat eater model, that's interesting because, you know, meat eater model somewhat starts with a Netflix show being picked up and other things, you know. I mean, today's meat eater model is a little bit different, but it's still based on the fact that a Netflix show was picked up, you know, in a hunting scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way to was that a television model or was that a streaming television model?
There was still money behind it enough to carry a cameraman around and stuff like that, you know, somehow.
True.
So, like, these are things that would be difficult for you in producing your own show. Would be, man, I'm going to have to pay a camera guy that knows what the heck he's doing to go on these crazy trips where, frankly, the one that we talked about yesterday that you're going to do this year, I asked you, you know, we kind of joked. I was like, you don't think you're going to die or something. Took you a second to answer that one, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, these aren't just run-of-the-mill, you know, getting a side-by-side and drive out in the field kind of thing, you know?
That's the exact problem. And it's not a problem that can't be overcome, but the truth is can I find a cameraman to follow me up 14,000-foot mountains actually carrying gear and getting me hunting or maybe not getting a bird and literally watching me descend into – some level of insanity while he's videoing. It's engaging for me to say it like that, but is a guy or a woman or anybody, quite frankly, going to do that?
You could find somebody, but you're going to have to pay them a lot.
You ain't going
to
find an intern to do it.
No.
Yeah.
No, you're not. Yeah.
That's, or at least one that'll stick around.
Yeah. And that's the, I think that's one of the
you
issues.
You guys know the challenge of getting good help.
Yeah. We can't find them. Well, I mean, where are they?
I know.
No, Eric's killer, man. He's, you know, for those who are watching right now, which, by the way, this is a video podcast as well. So those who are watching, this is Eric right here, and he is just knocking it in the head out here on these Map Scout challenges. He's going to shoot his first buck with a bow this year.
It's going to be exciting. Can't wait.
It's going to be awesome. He's learning a lot. He's kind of a newer hunter. We've talked about that with you on a podcast, I think, so far. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people might be familiar. But on these Map Scout challenges, the last couple of days, is there anything that's been anything that stuck out to you that you're like, that you took note of, or that surprised you, or kind of what's your whole vibe here?
Yesterday, I was telling you about how when we were going up that steep hill in Pennsylvania yesterday, I thought it was interesting how, because back home when I have a place that I hunt, that it's not obviously as steep and as, you know, elevation wise it's not as high, but we still have some pretty rigid stuff, and I found it interesting that it seemed like the deer were still moving about halfway up that hill, you know. And it's kind of just like back home. So
it's kind of like, that's what Casey talks about all the time, is like deer do deer stuff. So that's one thing, we can go and do all this stuff. Like, this is kind of stuff that is out of our element, if I could use a punny statement. But the thing is that Casey always talks about is like deer do deer stuff. They just have different habitats and different places that they live, right? So there are things that we can always say, this is what a deer will do because it's a deer. And so we can go to Ohio or Pennsylvania, and I think one of those things is, like you said, the elevation, you know, like wherever there's elevation, they're still using that similarly, you know. And we find that, like, for us a lot, creek bottoms are parallel to trails, essentially. They're a highway for deer to use a lot of times, and so, you know, anywhere we go, a creek bottom is typically a pretty decent place to find a white-tailed deer. So there's some cool things, you know, that we can use in these Map Scout challenges that help us to find deer in new habitat. And frankly, the Pennsylvania stuff was quite different than anything we've done. I could have stayed out there all day and just done the whole nature hiker thing. You know what I mean?
Oh,
I know
we
all felt the same. I mean, we sat there looking at milkweed with pollinators all over it for 20 minutes yesterday, just taking pictures and talking and watching these little bugs go nuts in there.
I was laying in it.
Yeah, you were laying in it. You spent some time laying down in it, and then for the rest of the day, you scratched for ticks.
And also look up spotted red eft.
Yeah.
If you guys want a fascinating story in wilderness not related to deer, spotted red eft. You have to look at that thing.
He spelled eft.
EFT.
I thought you spelled it differently, though.
Is there an H in there?
F-U-T. I'm still fascinated by that story.
Yeah.
Because I knew something about them, but we saw two yesterday. Yeah, oh, dude, and it's like deadly neurotoxin.
They're the same color as those jack-o'-lanterns.
KC was touching them.
Super crazy, though, man. The neurotoxin is super deadly, apparently. And they become less toxic as they age. They totally transform as they get older.
Just like they're just as they mature, right? As they mature,
relatively
maturity determines their toxicity.
It's kind of like a snake. You never know when ones will bite you. They can't control their venom.
So, they are poisonous, correct?
Well, you would say venomous.
No, venomous means that they
bite you. If you eat an eft or lick it, you're probably going to die.
What if you touch an eft and he pushes some poison out of
the
glands?
What if you touch an eft and then lick your fingers? Because I was thinking about that.
I'm still here.
I was trying to think about how many times you licked your fingers in the woods.
I don't do that a lot. because I'm kind of the guy who touches a lot of stuff. So I've kind of learned don't put your fingers in
y'all
your mouth.
Y'all touched every mushroom you saw yesterday.
Oh, yeah,
100% true. And how many species of mushrooms did we see?
Lots.
Over 20.
Yeah.
I'd say easily, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's tough to tell because they change with the station, you know, how mature they are.
Yeah.
But, I mean,
I'd say I found the coolest one just
Brian
to go
likes
ahead,
to, you
toot
did.
My own horn.
Brian likes to do this thing where he's like, oh, that one's edible for sure. I don't know. But that's an edible mushroom. And, which is a very dangerous game to play.
Yeah.
Both in, you know, in actuality and in just fun statements because... it might be, but man, alive.
We did take some home to eat, though.
We ate chanterelles last night, and they were awesome.
That's true. Yeah. Well, so, for clarity's sake, I've been hunting morel mushrooms my entire life in the Midwest. Morel mushrooms is a very small segment of the fungus world,
there's
I guess.
There's nothing in the world that looks like a morel mushroom. No, it is its own
thing. False morels are in the ballpark, but not really close.
But you can eat a false morel, and it's not a big deal.
It won't kill you. It'll make you not feel so hot.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Mm. But, so... Last year, I started expanding my fungus knowledge a little bit, and Casey's ate up with it. and Casey's got a friend, a wildlife officer friend in Texas, I believe, who's ate up with it.
He does.
And
yeah.
And so now I like every mushroom seems like it should be something you can eat. We got chanterelles up here for sure. I found a bunch last year. I didn't necessarily prepare them best way.
When you say for sure.
No. I was 82% sure on the mushrooms I found last year, and I didn't get sick eating them.
Yeah. So the with chanterelles, there are really three options when you see something that looks like a chanterelle.
Yeah.
There are jack-o'-lantern mushrooms, which you climbed a fence for, a legal fence.
Yeah.
But you climbed and this is a whole other thing, but there, for some reason, are high fences, like
8-foot
exclusion fences in the woods in Pennsylvania.
You climb sketchy one of those, to climb over, by the way.
Because you thought that there's a possibility that these might be chanterelles.
Yeah, because there's a big cluster.
Yeah, they end up being jack-o'-lantern mushrooms, which are
spooky.
More orange and have gills. What are those?
And have, the difference between gills are like when you look under a common toadstool, it's the thing that looks like Rosa.
Portobello's have them.
Yeah. When you look under a mushroom and it's got these little flappy things.
Yep.
Those are gills. They run from the stem, which I don't think it's called a stem in mushrooms.
Out to the cap. Yeah.
Out to the end of the hood.
Yeah.
So that's what jack-o'-lanterns have. And at night, apparently they have a tiny glow.
Which makes me want to go back out there and look at that thing at night,
man. I know, dude. Yeah, do you do long exposure on that?
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be cool.
That'd be fire.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah, literally.
Yeah, and then so they, but the chanterelles don't have gills. They have what you call veins.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, it looks like your, looks like my mom's leg. I was going to say your mom's leg, but I won't go there.
There's that. It's kind of, it looks, I would describe it more like if you stuck your neck out real far and flexed it and you went, and like all those tendons kind of show. That's kind of what they look like underneath. But then there's a middle ground. Jack-o'-lanterns will make you very, very sick and maybe hallucinate. Chanterelles are delicious. And there's a middle ground that that's the one we struggled with the most yesterday, are the false chanterelles.
Yeah.
Because, I think they're called false chanterelles,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So they look just like a chanterelle, feel like one, don't smell much different than a chanterelle, but you turn them over and there's still gills in there.
But sometimes the gills aren't that developed.
Yes.
And then that's where it gets to be this really strange line.
For an amateur like me, it's just like, okay, I'm not going to pick any tiny chanterelles because that's the way they got to be big. If they're big, then there's no way. But the thing with a false chanterelle, Tyler looked this up last night, they're just bitter.
They're just bitter.
But,
so,
they won't
but if you cut them into rough pieces and cook them all in the same saute skillet, you're going to end up with figuring out the whole thing is ruined pretty much.
Maybe.
You know?
Or maybe last night
or
we just.
Maybe we found a way to make them all wonderful.
That's right.
Maybe.
I don't know. But I remember yesterday at the end, for sure, I picked some false ones and we looked at them and decided, no, that's not a good.
Absolutely.
But so either way, we had our first chanterelles yesterday, Tyler, Eric, and I, and they are absolutely worth picking.
Yes.
Oh, my
butter,
gosh.
Salt, and a skillet. Kind of low heat, right, Brian?
Yeah.
Low to medium.
Chanterelles got a lot of moisture in them, and so you're trying to concentrate that flavor. So, and I don't want the butter to burn while you're concentrating the flavor. That's in my mind. If somebody's going to look at this and go, this guy did not fix chanterelles at all. Like I said, I'm new to the chanterelle thing, but I want to tell you what, worked out pretty good last night.
They can say what they want because improving on that's going to be hard.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
For sure.
It's tough. Yeah.
Yeah. So, man. I don't know. I think that the simple preparation for a lot of foraged things is a good deal. You know, like when it comes to blackberries or anything like that, like a simple preparation allows those flavors of nature to kind of come through, you know, and that's
exactly
what
you said last night when we put it in the skillet, because in case you put the rough chop on them, threw them in the butter while I was working on the chicken and waffle stuff, and you said, well, your gut feeling would be to throw in some onion with them, and I was like, yeah, but you guys want the full chanterelle experience, not the chanterelle and onion experience,
yeah,
you
sure.
know,
yeah.
at least for the first go around.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of ways to fix them, but that way was pretty good.
I mean, I'd do it every time, man.
Oh, yeah. I think that was pretty killer. I think that maybe if you used some shallots, something a little bit less, or you could do chanterelles and ramps, which are kind of like a shallot.
It's different seasons, though. That's the problem. You'd have to save enough ramp.
We had ramps last night that were fresh, so you had to save enough.
No, I saved them from the spring.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, but you could.
Yeah.
Man.
I meant to tell you that so we found enough to actually dehydrate some for KC to take back to Texas.
Maybe
transport an invasive, and they were pretty well done. I set them for another 3 hours on a really low temperature to get them dry, but you gotta have a good amount actually.
We have chanterelles at home.
Yeah, I know.
Red chanterelles.
I've seen some people that have posted some stuff about them, but
yeah.
You haven't had much luck finding them personally, right?
I haven't been out and done what we did.
Makes you want to, though.
Oh, yeah, it does. If they're that good, it's worth it.
Except in Texas, in the summertime, just everything's there to bite you, sting you, or kill you in some other way, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The sun is there, for sure.
Yeah, 110 degree hunting mushrooms. Yeah,
terrible.
What would be cool is if they actually glowed like jack-o'-lanterns, because then you could go out at night and find them and eat them. But
you don't want
the glowing mushrooms.
You could use the jack-o'-lanterns as the indicator species.
Have you ever heard of foxfire? Do you know what Fox
Wasn't that a movie back in the 80s?
There's a very good possibility. It's also a series of books that are written about kind of woodsmanship stuff. It's really cool.
Wood County,
Wood County, there you go. Foxfire is, it's probably a common name for some stuff. Man, it's kind of flooded around here. Look at that barn.
Yeah, recently we were super dry for a while, and then all of a sudden we've gotten, you guys have been here, we've gotten bombed down on thunderstorms every day.
We stood underneath trees trying to seek shelter for about 30 minutes the other day.
That's going to be a huge video.
Yeah.
I'm going to need to flood a urinal pretty soon, just by the way. So.
Anyways, foxfire is a fungus. I think it's kind of like that dog puke stuff. You know what I'm talking about? Dog puke fungus that you get in your garden.
That's got to be a Texas thing.
It's like a slime fungus.
Never heard of that.
But it glows like that too, supposedly.
Dog puke glows like that.
No, it's not actually dog puke.
It's got to be named aptly, right? It's got to look like dog puke if you
name it. I think maybe so. I mean, I don't know for sure. But anyways, I thought maybe you'd know what foxfire was. But it probably is. Everything's edible at least once.
That's
the creed of the mushroom hunter.
They've been trying. Casey's been trying every berry we walked past. He tried a choke cherry. First time, you didn't know what those were.
No.
Really choked on it.
There's not a lot. Well, I shouldn't say this on the podcast. I'll say it this way. I'm not super concerned about dying from a berry in North America. However, I maybe should be. But I was pretty confident that was a choke cherry because I actually had phone service, so I looked it up. Choke cherries are just like a raw persimmon in cherry version, so don't eat those. However, we ate a wild strawberry, which was kind of a sandy, watery type thing, which, I mean, it wasn't bad, but it's just not as good as a store-bought one. I tried wild raspberries, which are some of the best stuff you'll ever eat in your life.
That's right. Mm-hmm. You could never find enough of those.
Oh, man. Because we found both kinds. We found the black caps and the reds.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those reds they were in those apple trees. They were so good.
Those reds are when I was growing up, my grandma would make a pie. We only find enough around our property to make one pie a year, and it's one of my best childhood memories.
Sounds good. Yeah. And then tried some of the apples.
Blueberries.
Those apples were, I mean, they just didn't have the sugars, but they weren't bad. You know, they just weren't very good.
You hit the blueberries, though, and those were...
Oh, man. And I think we might have had some huckleberries in there, too. The ones a little bit redder.
Kind of huckleberry-looking thing.
Those things, that was better than blueberries. Those huckleberry ones were bad.
Yeah.
Bad bum.
The weird part about the choke cherry and what you're saying is I know people that make choke cherry jam. So at some point, that either gets ripe or you put enough sugar in it and it makes it good.
That's it.
Right?
Yeah. And a lot of times, tannins disappear when you do certain processes to them. So maybe whenever you boil them, the tannin kind of goes away or whatever.
Yeah.
But, I mean, people make rose hip jelly. I mean, who cares to eat a rose hip?
You ever put a rose hip in your mouth?
I have.
No.
Ain't the best tasting thing.
Yeah.
No,
oh, yeah.
It's not that great.
And talk about a mealy, but I don't get that. That doesn't... Mm.
This is kind of way out there, but you've been in this country, and I want you to tell me what the names of these things are, because the upland birds hammer them in Colorado. They're a short bush, about thigh high, and they have little white berries on them.
So the white ones are winterberry.
Winterberry. They're sugar. They're sweet as sugar.
And there's another species out there that's called silver buffalo berry, I believe.
Uh-huh. SBBs?
When I released the second season of Way Up Glen, we talked about it some because we're biking through a lot of that.
Are you still releasing that through our channel or what?
We're talking about it. We're in negotiations.
Let's go, baby.
But that winterberry, you know, sheep like that too, though. I was at a place in Colorado where they're, public ground always for me and for the most part of public access. And they, the year I was there, ptarmigan like it. So I was in this on the specific mountain hunting. There was winterberry on that mountain, and the ptarmigan were filled up with it.
Mm-hmm.
Just hammered it. I go back the next year, and apparently the sheep lease had re-upped.
Mm-hmm.
The sheep had browsed that winterberry to the nubs. Not
talking about domestic sheep?
Yeah. Not a single winterberry in the entire mountain, and not a single ptarmigan.
Well, I know a place that shall not be disclosed that there is probably acres of that stuff, and there are always turkeys and bluegrass there.
Oh, yeah.
In Colorado. Yeah. So, do you have to, adjust, where you were headed, or do some scouting on the map, or how did you figure out where to go find birds whenever you kind of ran into that issue with the winterberries being eaten?
Well, that's the problem with ptarmigan. They either are where they are or they aren't where they aren't.
Oh man, that's such a not hunting cliche.
I don't that's the only way to describe it.
Gotta be on the X, man.
There's no, you can't scout for them. I mean, I'd love to see you guys try. I'm all game for that anytime you want to do that, but the problem is you've literally had to hike up to, we were at 12.7, I think, is where we were. So when
I'm founding winterberry way lower than that. Did you know that that's a thing?
Yeah, but ptarmigan or
there's no ptarmigan there. Yeah, so. What?
Where did you find winterberry? In the state of Colorado, you mean?
Oh, yeah. At 8,300.
White-tailed ptarmigan, as high as they can go.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. There's no ptarmigan there, so.
Might be, though.
Might be.
Do they taste better because of that sugar berry they're eating, you think?
They taste good no matter what. Yeah. And that's relative to how much work you put in, I think. I mean, when you're climbing to, take one of those birds and then you put that thing in your mouth on a campfire that evening, you're like, wow, that's the best bird I've ever tasted. But it's probably a direct correlation to that's the hardest bird I've ever had to. And not in terms of, they're not real sketchy as far as shooting goes. Mm-hmm. I mean, or, dog work, but they're sketchy. In terms of how much effort it takes to get to their country. So, it's the best tasting bird you ever put in your mouth because it's
so brutal. It's hard to scout ptarmigan.
It is.
But can you scout the other stuff today, or when we're in Ohio or Pennsylvania, were you scouting for particular things, or is it habitat? Is it food or habitat that you're looking for?
Depends on the bird. I'm looking for both, which is cool because you guys were talking about that on the Map Scout. You guys were talking about that on the Map Scout, about the layers on that Onyx? Onyx. I say Onyx. But these guys, I don't know. Every time I say it, they make fun of me. The new layers stuff that they've got going on is...
The crop layer stuff.
It's crop layers, but it's also the cut layers. Right?
Oh, yeah.
So,
you got that.
So, in terms of that, with the...
Good, how are you?
I got more.
So, in terms of that, I'll wait till I get Garth.
Are you embarrassed, bro? Yes. Are you embarrassed, lady?
She doesn't want to hear about ptarmigan.
I'm going to pee my pants.
She might want to hear about ptarmigan.
She's a Steeler fan.
Thank you. So, maybe in terms of ptarmigan, Onyx doesn't have a winterberry layer.
I'll put that in for you.
put the winterberry order in for me. So that makes it for timing it. It's not applicable.
So you can't you can't assume that when you get up to 12,000 feet, there's going to be winterberry on any mountain.
No, because one year I'm at that's a good point. Is on that specific mountain with the there was winterberry one year, and then the following year the sheep. There was no winterberry.
Okay, so, get your brows down.
So, but I can use it for other species of birds. Absolutely, I could use both those things, like food source and habitat, and rough grouse, like we're talking about today.
Yeah.
Certainly could go that direction. Although rough grouse, I wouldn't be focusing on food. I'd be focusing on cuts.
So where we went in Ohio, there's really not much for upland hunting down there, right? There's no bobs, right?
Yeah.
And there's no pheasants, really. They're, I mean, they release them, but you don't really want to participate in that.
Yeah.
So, but we were scouting around for whitetail stuff and whitetail food, and we found that stuff with layers and stuff. But then we're like, and that was kind of more of like a, I don't know, crop slash big or slash woodlot scenario. And then yesterday we went to Pennsylvania, and we were kind of looking for the same type of habitat for both, and sometimes at least. Like, you were talking about that, like, I always want to say pre-emergent, but that's not the right word. It's early secessional. Yes.
Yeah.
Early secessional growth is what you're looking for.
That's right.
Is that food or habitat or both?
That's both for rough grouse.
Yeah.
Mainly because it's so thick. I mean, and for woodcock as well.
We did see a woodcock this year.
We did. I don't want to interrupt you. I want you to continue on. But when you say it's so thick, is that because all the rough grouse that live out there in the thin stuff are getting smoked by bobcats, so they just end up in the thick stuff, or do they truly like just live there only?
It's exactly that. They're not, and I don't think they're getting smoked by bobcats. They're getting the reason to for grouse to be in the early secessional stuff and the thick stuff is because of raptors. I mean, primarily.
Really?
I mean, you know, that's where the death from above is much more
talking about velociraptors, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So is it the grouse that survives by probability because that's where he was born and lives that lives in the thick stuff, or is it the grouse that's smart enough to emigrate from the open woodland stuff to the early secessional growth that you're finding?
We're gonna have to ask the grouse on that one. I mean, if I'm hypothesizing, I think that it's generational, generational, way generational, and that the best learned behavior is the one rewarded in nature.
Yeah.
You know, like the grouse have learned or there's that's an interesting topic. So I'll go to pheasant and Kansas. You guys, you know, I hunt in Kansas.
We only talk about natives on this podcast.
I know. Well, we, you know, Pheasants Forever would say that pheasants are now native.
Okay,
but.
Well, there's a term for that, right? They've naturalized. Isn't that what it's called?
I've never heard it used in terms of animals. I've only heard it used in terms of people.
Oh, really?
Naturalized citizens.
Yeah.
But that is an interesting term. Okay, I'm going to start using that
now. I think that would work.
Because it's less offensive to people.
Yeah.
But we've always had a theory in Kansas, or me and my friends and my dad have joked about Kansas, and that the pheasant in Kansas is an entire different subspecies.
That's what y'all actually say?
Yeah, we do. Because if you don't hunt Kansas on opening week, what you find is that the rooster pheasant, the ones that are the most successful are the ones that refuse to fly.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they don't fly. And so our running joke is that at some point a Kansas pheasant is going to lose its wings because they just don't. The successful ones aren't using them, right?
As a pheasant, because you talk about this a lot, 70% of upland game die every year, and they repopulate that year. That's kind of the rough factor.
Yeah, the annual mortality rate.
By species, it makes a difference.
By species and by what's going on with weather and everything else. But yeah, lots of factors. But it's somewhere between 70% and 80%, honestly.
Yeah. So are pheasants in that, or are they a little bit more longer lived?
No, they're definitely a prime example of that. Average pheasant mortality easily above 70%. We know this because pheasant, when you shoot a pheasant, murder pheasant, I was about to say harvest, and now I'm working on my words.
What about,
I
got to
work on my words.
I have a question. Can we use the term individually extirpate?
That's long. It's hard. That one's hard to grasp. I'm not offended by any term you're going to find a term that I'll be offended by. So, anyways, when you shoot a pheasant and you bring it to hand, you can tell very easily the difference between a juvie bird, a first-year bird, mm-hmm. and a three-year-old, which is the anomaly. And then I'm sure somebody has shot a four-year-old bird, but when you have a one-year-old bird and a three-year-old bird side by side, it's like, it's night and day. Mm-hmm. Body weight wise, tail length certainly, which is what a lot of guys would measure, you know.
Did you see, like, 2 years ago, I'm sure we sent it to you, but the DNR from a certain state reposted this, like, can you believe the tail feather on this bird? And it was one of those, you know, stupid
doubled
two
up.
Tail feathers doubled up thing, and they thought it was real.
Yeah,
you remember that?
Yeah, we talked about that.
I think I thought it was real, so it looked pretty good.
It looked good.
They did good.
But you think a DNR would be better at that, but they're really, really not. Across the board.
That'll take us down a path that's going to, this podcast will go for 14 hours.
We'll do that one on the way home.
If we want to start in on conservation, DNR, then oh God, well, I don't even know where that goes. But the other thing about it, what I even beyond tail length on a very mature pheasant, the thing that I'm really looking for are mm-hmm. the silver tips on the spurs. You know, super mature 3-year-old pheasant, besides having a really long tail and heavier body weight, is going to have these spurs that have white tips on them. We call them ivory tips, mm-hmm. and it's just rare. So maybe that's a 1% bird, less than 1% bird. A 3-year-old pheasant, you know, to survive 1 year is you're only going to get that chance about 25% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
We got hosed on the reentry.
The road's closed.
Oh, no, that's not good.
that was not well planned out as a pit stop. We're gonna find a workaround.
We could make it.
We could make it happen.
Some people have been cutting across.
So do you ever cut the spurs off pheasant?
No. I keep my hides. I generally don't cut spurs off pheasant. Although I bet there's some guys.
What if
have.
You had a pheasant spur necklace? You seen them guys that do that for turkeys?
Turkeys, yeah.
That's cool, man.
Or for hog's teeth and stuff.
Yeah. I got some for javelina cutters. Teeth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
What noise does a javelina make?
Oh, you don't want to hear it. It's loud.
If you do it, I will hit you.
I'll do it.
it's the loudest thing you've ever heard in your life.
It's a very velociraptor type noise. Yeah. I mean,
I've seen them before. I mean, bird hunting.
Dude. I truly believe that is the meanest wild animal that there is. They are. I'm telling you, the temperament of a javelina is the worst thing. I was camped out on top of a mountain in West Texas. We were catching elk in a pen. And
we're gonna have to backtrack.
These javelinas ran through our camp and woke us up. And when we got up, they were surprised. So then they tried to like charge at us to get us to leave. Luckily, my buddy had. I mean, I don't think they would have killed us, you know. But like, either way, it was nice that my friend had.
You get your femoral.
Yeah, they could. And they have some sharp teeth. You think hog tusks are sharp? Goodness gracious, javelina teeth are ridiculous.
You could have speared one and got canceled.
I didn't have any spears.
Canceled?
But my buddy had a...
from your primary sponsor.
He had a judge, like a Taurus judge or whatever they're called. They shoot 410 shells.
Yeah.
Yeah. He had that thing. He just went to shoot in amongst them, and they ran off after that. But... then, you know, we were on a javelina vendetta and shot a few the next day. And, like, you'd shoot one, and it'd go to make that crazy javelina noise. And then the other ones would just attack it, almost like chickens do or turkeys do whenever another one gets shot.
Mm,
and
nasty.
They'd go, they're wild, dude.
Why do you think turkeys do that?
I'm sure it's a survival instinct.
Well, their brain is so small, they're easily deceived.
They're mad about their deception.
Right. That flopping around makes that turkey think it's a decoy.
Yep. I shot a coyote one time with a bow, and KC was with me.
Oh, man, that was bad.
We were on public land in Texas. I shot a coyote with a bow, and it was the last one I've ever shot. And he ran off, like, 60 yards. He's with a pack of, like, three others, I think. and then just proceeded to, I guess, get attacked by the rest of them for the for the next hour.
I said,
okay, I'm not shooting any more things like that.
I was sad in the tree stand after that.
I learned my lesson, Brian.
Yeah, learned my lesson.
We've got an alliance with the coyote as well, by the way.
Chickens. You've seen this probably, but like if you get a hen chicken that gets like kind of messed up or something, like the other chickens will peck it, kill it.
Yeah.
It just
birds are mean creatures.
They're mean, dude.
They are, dude.
They are mean for sure. But
that's why I go after them, primarily because they're so mean.
Yeah.
So we're going the opposite way now?
Well, after that stop, we're now no longer headed to Michigan. We're going to be map scouting. Let's see.
Bass Pro Shops.
Southern Ohio here in a hot second.
So we are headed to Michigan like we talked about a little while ago. I think we're pretty close to Michigan right now, aren't we?
Yeah, we're in Toledo right now. We're about to turn around at this big Bass Pro Shop. Shout out to Bass Pro Shops. Hit us up if you want to be a sponsor. Me primarily, Element.
Please. All it takes to be sponsored by Bass Pro is to just go film a segment in the parking lot before you go on your hunt.
I think that's right.
I think we should do that for
you. You know, Johnny's a pretty big proponent of conservation, from what I understand.
Private conservation.
He spends a lot of money on it, from what I understand.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. What do you think about
Brian's a skeptic.
I got a hot take, and I'm not going to share it.
Good. That's perfect, man, because that's a good way to not get sponsored. we just got another person signing up for the Hagerman scouting stuff that we're going to do. So, real quick plug, while I'm thinking about it, since I just got the notification, we're doing a basically just kind of like an in-person scouting session. Sorry, on the Hagerman National Wildlife Refuge here in North Texas, or there in North Texas, and we're not there. And if you want to be a part of that, you can go to our website, go to the shop, and you can buy a ticket. And Chad Rice from Cruiser Saddles will be there, and he will be kind of giving a demo of how to run a saddle, what to think about when you set up a saddle, and probably letting some guys get in and test some of the saddles. So if you're interested in that, small ticket price helps us to rent a room at a hotel so that we can all get in the out of the heat after the morning of scouting, and we can do some map scouting after we've been on the property to talk about other places that might be good there. So if you're thinking about hunting the Hagerman, which a lot of these Texas guys are that follow us, it's a good chance to all put our brains together and help each other be successful out there.
Yeah, and maybe just learn a little bit about whitetail scouting in general. I think the reason that we were going to go do the Hagerman thing is because it's a place that whitetails most likely lay down a lot of sign.
Yeah,
and
a little more whitetail-like.
Yeah, it's a little bit more
less pressure.
Of course, controlled hunt. So, or they control the hunting pressure there. So, whitetail are going to do more whitetail type stuff and leave more sign. So, I think it's a good opportunity for us to get out there. And
what part of Texas is that in?
North Texas. So near Sherman, Texas, north of DFW. I'm doing that thing where I get indigestion that Tyler talks about. So
it's fun to edit. Stand interviews.
That's when right. That's but anyways, I'm excited about that, man. I think it's going to be a good time, and I think that we'll probably do some Q&A stuff, of course, with that, and maybe have somebody else show up and help us learn some stuff.
Yeah,
too.
You also get a free shirt if you buy the ticket, so you get to pick a shirt when you're there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So right now we are headed to Michigan. We've been trying to get to this topic, but there's all these little side trips we keep taking, right?
Definitely shiny object syndrome.
Not even figurative side trips. Like, we literally just went to the side to go pee for Tyler, and now we made a little detour.
But, hey, there's Bass Pro again. Or is that a different one?
I don't know.
Johnny's still there.
You said this morning that Michigan is rough grouse central. You said there's a lot of rough grouse up here.
There are,
which is a blue grouse, right?
No, rough grouse is its own thing.
Okay.
It can't get a blue grouse pregnant.
Can it not?
Ooh. Is there a possibility that there's a hybrid rough grouse, blue grouse out there?
Here's one of those things.
Are grouse pregnant, or do they just have eggs inside of them?
That's a good question. I suppose they're pregnant for a little bit. But, are they a species because of a geographic boundary or because of genetic difficulties in reproduction? You know what I mean?
Like, well, what level of a scientific name can impregnate another level of a scientific name?
I think that's dependent on the critter. Because, dude, a donkey and a zebra can have a baby.
Yeah, but they've got to share some level of scientific name.
Well,
right?
Sure. I mean, I don't think they share a level of name. I think you're probably talking about taxonomy here. So I don't think that the genus of zebra is the same thing as the genus of donkey, because zebra is a genus in itself, because there's multiple species of zebra.
So does the donkey find the zebra attractive, or does the zebra find the donkey attractive?
You have to ask him.
I think the donkey uses its genus to make this happen. I'm
so,
not sure.
Back to Rough Grouse in Michigan. We're headed up here, and we're going to kind of scout some of the same type of stuff, right, for this deal. I mean, of course, we're going for a whitetail, map scout challenge, but you're going to be looking for rough grouse stuff and mushrooms while we're running around.
Surely. Yeah, I think that's I'll be looking for cuts. You know, it's the same thing that we were hoping, or I was hoping to see over in Allegheny. And the weird part about Allegheny is my definition of cut versus what I know as a fairly standard definition in Michigan, which when you talk about cuts in Michigan, Michigan is a very large timbering state.
Yeah, they're into the clear cut.
They cut.
Yeah.
And the stuff we saw over in the forest the other day, not that it was all this way, but, you know, because we saw a fraction. Mm-hmm. We saw a fraction. Mm-hmm. Allegheny, for those of you that don't know, is this massive resource. You should go there. It's absolute. I was amazed by
me
it.
Too.
Oh, me too.
Me too.
But the cuts that we were at, they were select harvest.
Yeah.
And I don't know that they're... And so Onyx didn't really differentiate between those two things, I don't think, right?
No.
So
I think that'd be pretty difficult to do, because yeah. I'm sure that's just on the company books. That's about what it is.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure. Yeah, so I think you're right. But so when we were walking in, I was thinking we were going to clear cuts that were 6, 7, 8 years old, mm-hmm. and really it turns out they were pretty much select cuts.
Yeah.
And they still had a lot of very well-established hardwood in there, and that wouldn't be stuff that I'd be going towards as a rough grouse hotspot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But
what about over here where you have areas that may seasonally flood, and that's going to prevent hardwoods from growing, but you might have some smaller type early successional stuff that kind of comes and goes. Is that also rough grouse habitat?
It can't. I've hunted some swamp grouse before.
Yeah.
It's really difficult hunting.
I bet you love it.
It's funny in some regards. Shout out Brittany Booth. She showed me the first time we went swamp grouse hunting. She went in up to her waist and in a pothole. I mean, like, you know, super.
Beaver run?
It was bad stuff, man. But we did shoot a bird back in there.
That's cool.
So they're in there.
Swamp pheasants are a thing too, right? I guess maybe not in Michigan, but like they like those cattail marshes, right?
That's the part of the reason that, in my view, somebody could probably argue against this. The biologist might say you're a lunatic, but in South Dakota, and North Dakota, there's so much pothole region where it's surrounded by cattails.
Mm-hmm.
And those pheasant, if you've been in those cattails in the wintertime, you can understand why pheasant go in there. First of all, nothing can go anywhere close to those pheasants without them being able to hear the approach.
Yeah, it's loud.
It's loud, loud. That mm-hmm. stuff's super dry.
Mm-hmm.
And it also is probably a 10-degree raise in temperature,
really?
Just from the insulation of that of thick cattails.
Makes sense.
So that's why up there, in my view, they have a fairly good static core base.
In the winter, those cattails kind of fold over and make tents almost, and they make little holes. For
little
things to
holes.
Get,
if you go into those things to pursue birds in the wintertime when there's snow on the ground, you'll see that. You'll see their tracks, and they're going in under those
little pheasant igloo.
Yeah.
So what we're going to do today? Do you consider that part of the process of the hunt, which you love the process? Is this something that like is fun for you, or is it just something you're kind of just doing as you're tagging along here?
Yeah, it's fun to see new areas. For me, though, the scouting wise, I don't tend to go to destination states to scout prior to the season in person. I look at weather data for the year and emergency haying and cropping data for the year, and then I kind of base it off of that, and then just my general knowledge of bird behavior, I guess. But you know, that's one of the things that's different, because you guys are up here, you know, scouting, and you know, I think, well, the Ohio Map Scout that you guys are, you know, getting ready to release or release sometime in the near future, you know, you think you narrowed in on where, I guess you guys are saying that there's a big buck that you think you may have, like, honed in on, or well, at least a home range, I guess. Is that what you would say?
In Ohio?
Yeah.
I think there's a good chance.
Yeah. So, but you expect that animal to be in that general vicinity, like, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And with cameras, I mean, the you guys are using the Moultrie stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah. We actually hung a cell cam there on a bean field, expecting to get pictures of a deer that we found sign for in the hardwoods. You know, that's going to be kind of the food source or whatever this time of year.
Mm-hmm. So what would be the trigger to trip that and go, okay, then we're going back there to hunt? Like, what would be the determining factor on that?
See, I think that's the huge difference in upland and whitetail, is that we're looking for a specific animal. You're looking for a population of animals.
That's right. I mean, in some regards, I was trying to segment out exactly what, you know, and that was public land too. So there's going to be other guys that are going to have the ability to hunt in there as well.
And,
so.
And maybe that's the other thing too. It's not just a specific animal, but maybe there is a echelon that we're trying to achieve of multiple animals that make that. You know what I mean? So maybe it's age class, kind of getting back to the maturity thing that we were talking about, or antler size. You know, you have, if you pick up five deer on a piece of public property off of one camera that are all, let's, you know, go with scoring system, because it actually is an accurate gauge of maturity across the board. So if you go with something that is, you know, a 125 Boone and Crockett class deer, and you have seven of those across the board, there's a good chance that you have quite a few older age class deer there to hunt. Whereas if you hang a camera 3 miles from there, you have one of that. It's like, man, that ain't the move. You know,
what's the I just like the
move.
What's the move? What's
move.
The?
So there's inside jokes that nobody's getting. I love it.
So what's the bottom barrier? For Ohio specifically. I just want to talk Ohio specifically.
Well, that's going to kind of depend, because when we do this Map Scout Challenge stuff, it's for the public. So it's not really a place that we're going to go back and hunt. Now, if there's a 287 that shows up there, we're probably not going to tell anybody about it. But for the most part, that's the idea. It's more for public information, not so that people can go there and hunt those specific deer, because that would be silly. But the idea is to go and show as much of the habitat and as much of the country and kind of the demographic and breakdown of, you know, ag to timber to swamp and yada yada, to give people an idea of how to scout for whitetails in that country, and then what you're going to find in an area that looks similar to that, so that they can apply that to their own places that they either hunt locally or when they travel out of state. Mm-hmm. So,
but if a 200 shows up on camera, the people are going to see the spot, right?
Yeah.
What if what if the 200 shows up after the fact?
I don't think we'll release it until then.
So, when do these come out? That's a good. I like that.
Yeah, probably August.
Probably. We released Map Scout Challenges last year that had big deer in them.
Like big deer,
150 plus inch deer. You know.
Yeah.
So two different places. Missouri. We did one in Missouri that had a big deer on it, big 10 point, and then one in Illinois in Shawnee that was, you know, I think it was a big 9 with some kind of junky bases or something.
Yeah, and there was another really good deer on that camera as well.
Deer that any of us would love to kill.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, we can almost expect as much in Ohio in a good spot, but who knows if that happens, you know. And I don't know. I think in Pennsylvania, we're looking at something that's quite a bit smaller that'll probably show up and we'll be stoked about, you know, but we got a good spot over there. And then here in Michigan, I think it's really going to be I don't know what to expect, because like we were saying earlier, like it's kind of where it all started, and we'll kind of wrap it up on that, but like it's a weird deal because they have the genetics and, you know, the crops, and it's northern latitudes, so they're, the potential for big deer are there, you know, it's like it's a thing that can happen. But are there going to be enough limiting factors to make it not happen? And I'm assuming that's what you're looking at. Like, you know, South Dakota has the potential for really good upland hunting, but the limiting factors of drought and emergency hay grazing and yada yada might make it to where it doesn't really have that this year, right? And I think that, just like we were talking about how with upland birds, you know, since 70% of the birds die every year and they repopulate, you live on a very year-to-year basis on what's good and what's not. In our world, the year-to-year doesn't happen as much. It's almost generationally, you know. Like, 20 years ago, there were parts of Illinois that were just the baddest places in the world to hunt whitetails. And now that information has gotten out, and it's not really what it used to be, or at least that's what people like to say, you know. And that's probably a whole nother rabbit hole to dive down into, but you kind of get what I'm saying. If we go scout a place and it doesn't look very good, it's probably not going to be very good next year either. But that's not to say that in 5 or 10 years, whenever things change around there,
yeah,
it couldn't be.
I mean, that's definitely a difference with upland there, and that's why folks can write articles going, these are the best places to go upland hunting, and they're also using a meter that doesn't necessarily apply to what I do. So
yeah, what's best, right?
Yeah. What's best? I don't really care that much about the number of birds I shoot. What I like to do, honestly, is I like to, something I've done historically is I like to find places where people don't expect there to be birds, mm-hmm. and then dig one out. I find that satisfying in some regard, to go someplace where they're just like, there's no way you're going to see something there, and make it happen.
So, if that is the case, since you've spent some time walking around in Texas Public with us, is there a part of you that wants to go down there and hunt bobwhites and try to make it happen?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we already talked about it. I mean, it's just, you know, where do we fit it in?
What about Bigfoots?
You not don't. Bigfoots, but...
There's a lot of people that don't expect Bigfoots to be a real thing.
Chuckalaka Forever, that new conservation organization, is Chuckalaka Forever. Those guys are onto something there.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah,
the range of the Chuckalaka is expanding.
Well, man.
As far as I know, all you need is some fire on the landscape and birds will go nuts. Right?
Yeah, that's all it takes, dude.
That's all it
takes.
If you
want a turkey, you burn a spot, and he'll be there.
Let's just plant an acre of habitat. It don't matter where. It doesn't matter what's around it.
No,
if we're the habitat organization...
You can't plant it. You have to save it. Save the habitat.
You know, if we're the habitat organization, our acronym is HOE. Just so you know.
That's about
Habitat Organization of the Element.
That is apt.
So we are about in Michigan, and I think we are to the point where we are going to start being a little bit crazy. So I think it's a good time to kind of wrap this thing up. Guys, if you enjoy this kind of stuff, be sure and subscribe to what Brian has going on over at Ultimate Upland. He's really, I know we were tooting his horn for him because he doesn't like to do it. But he does some really, really awesome stuff. I mean, things that I'm not willing to even do. So the only way, if you're the same kind of person, the only way you can enjoy such things is to go, you know, see what he writes and what he puts out there video content-wise and whatnot. So, dude, I really do appreciate how much you have done for us on this trip. Honestly, if we haven't had you to help us do the Map Scout Challenge stuff, with Map Scout Challenge stuff, both with local knowledge and just, you know, a place to stay with hospitality and then quality meals to refuel us every night, you know, like, I don't think that, this would be way less enjoyable, but B, like, I don't think that we would be as effective or efficient, so.
We might not even be here.
Yeah, we might not, honestly, we very well might not be up in here.
Up in here. I'm just real appreciative of the fact that you guys are teaching me how to say things.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
That's what I love, you know, having you guys up here to teach me.
Y'all gonna make me lose my mind.
All right, so the 2022.
What are we teaching you? What, by the way? What's the best thing we've taught you?
Apparently, I have problems with O's. Yeah. Anything with O's in it, and I can't say your name, which I'm not exactly sure because I thought I said Tyler,
But apparently that's not how you say Tyler.
It's not.
You're trying to really put a Southern emphasis on the way you said it just then. Brian is chameleonic.
I thought you were going to say my last name was Junes.
Junes. Johns.
No. That may be how your daughter pronounces it.
No, she doesn't.
But, yeah, my O's are, I need to work on my O's. If I'm going to become a podcaster.
Are you?
Then I have to work on my O's.
Wait a second. Are you going to become a podcaster?
I don't know. I hear it's the way to get very popular.
We should at least think about it, for sure.
Yeah, we should think about that. Well, anyway, subscribe to Brian's new podcast. It's going to be called The
Season.
Ultimate Way to Be an Uplander.
Chuck like a forever.
What is it? It's ultimateupland.com?
Ultimate Upland all the time. Yeah, everywhere.
Yeah, everywhere.
And check out what he's got going on. Be sure to check out the Map Scout Challenges on YouTube. We have a playlist there from the 2020 versions of those. We went to a lot of really cool states for that. We got the 2021 ones coming out pretty soon. If you haven't yet, go sign up for the Element Scouting Session in August. And while you're on our website, that's where you sign up for that, by the way. You go to the website. You can pay for that there at the shop on our website, theelementwild.com. Log in there, buy your shirt for you and your friends, and be sure and subscribe to this podcast as well. And remember also that this is your element.
Live in it. Live in it.
You ever get that feeling, the walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins. Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today.